As you see from the slide up on the TV, we're going to be studying from Judges chapter 7, if you would like to turn there. And I would like to, in just a few moments, read the second verse, but I think it is important, first of all, to set a little context, especially for those who have not been able to come, whether it be for other duties or for whatever reason, to the Wednesday night class, because this actually is a period of time that we discussed in broad terms on Wednesday evening. What we are engaging in is a survey of the Bible. The Bible from 20,000 feet is the book that we're loosely following. Dennis is doing a wonderful job. And we discussed last Wednesday the period of the judges. And there are some who might struggle to see the benefits of studying Old Testament history. I think that it's easily defensible, and it's certainly easily defensible what we have been doing on Wednesday evening as we're thinking of the most significant events in the history of God's relationship with man, his treatment of man, because with those epochs of history and those large and important persons that we have spoken of, there is much that we need to learn and we benefit from learning that will help us as we seek to live for Christ in our day and time. But I think all of it is important. And taking a more microscopic view of the text, I do want to emphasize Romans 7 and verse 2 in a few moments. Because that one verse, I think, gives us a very important lesson to learn on the subject of self-exaltation that I hope will be beneficial to you. Romans chapter 14 and verse 4, the Apostle Paul agrees with that sentiment when he said, whatever things are written before time were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. And so let's give just for a few moments. We won't spend much time in it, but for a few moments, let's get a bit of context before we examine Judges 7. And what I do want to note again is why the judges came about, as we talked about on Wednesday evening. We're told in Judges chapter 2 and verse 10 that following the death of Joshua and all of the elders who outlived Joshua, who saw the mighty works of God, we are told that another generation arose after them. That's Judges 2 and verse 10. Another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work that he had done for Israel. It's amazing how a single untaught generation, a single generation that has not been established in the truths of God, can lead to wholesale apostasy. And on this occasion, they provoked God to anger, this new generation who had not seen the works of God, because they were idolatrous and because they were disobedient. And as a result of that, God allowed the enemies that surrounded Israel to plunder them and to oppress them. Consider the following words in Judges 2 and verse 15, verses 15 through 19. Wherever they went out, we are told, the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them. They were greatly distressed. Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played their harlot with other gods, and they bowed down to them and turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so. When the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them out of the hands of their enemies all the days of the judge, for the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who had oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass that when the judge was dead, that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them, and they did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. Now, Wednesday evening, Dennis went through about six different things that came in this particular cycle. The book actually supplied four, all from the point of view of men that had the letter R as the acrostic to follow. It's very helpful in the memory of that. First of all, they were rebellious. Secondly, they were repressed because of their rebellion. Thirdly, they repented because God sent judges hearing their groaning. And then there was that period of renewal or victory as a result of what the judges had accomplished. I forgot what the R of the last one was. Do you remember? Offhand, not in the book. So there are those four R's. You can supply the four R's you want if you would like to. But that cycle is one that needs to be remembered because this was something that was typical during the days of the judges. You'll notice there that in verse 19, we saw that downward spiral of which Dennis mentioned. It came to pass that when the judge was dead, they reverted, they behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods. This was a period of about 350 years. Now, we're going to go fairly early in the cycle of judges. There had been four before Gideon in Judges chapter 7. Othniel, which was Caleb's younger brother. Remember, Caleb was the one with Joshua who had given the good report of the situation in the land of Canaan. There was Ehud, a Benjamite. There was Shamgar, who is very quickly spoken of in a single verse. And then there was Deborah, a prophetess of God, who all served as judges and had their victories as they delivered Israel during their lifetimes. And then we get to Gideon. Gideon was the fifth judge who served God during this period of Israel's history. He came to deliver the Jews this time from the oppression of the Midianites. And he is described in Judges chapter 6 and verse 12. Chapter 6 and verse 12, as a mighty man of valor. And he was given instructions in verse 14 of the text. The Lord turned to Gideon. He said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" That is, a thumbnail exactly how God worked through the judges during that period of time. So we find an occurrence where Gideon tore down the altar of Baal in his hometown of Ophrah. He brought the wrath of the Midianites upon himself. The battle indeed was drawn, the battle lines, and the conflict with the Midianites became imminent. We're told in Judges 7 and verses 2 through 7, as we relate this particular occasion, the Lord said to Gideon, "The people who are with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying my own hand has saved me." You'll notice that is the verse that we're going to emphasize. But going on in verse 3, he gave instructions to Gideon, "Therefore proclaim in the hearing of the people, saying, whoever is fearful and afraid, let him turn and depart at once from Mount Gilead." And 22,000 of the people returned, 10,000 remained. So even though there was two-thirds of the people that were afraid, they didn't want to be involved in the battle, we are told that 10,000 were willing to fight. The Lord said to Gideon, "These people are still too many. So bring them down to the water. I will test them for you there. It will be that of whom I say to you, this one shall go with you, the same will go with you. And whoever I say to you, this one shall not go with you, the same shall not go." So, this was the test. He brought the people down to the water. The Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps from the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set apart by himself. Likewise, everyone who gets down on his knees to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hand to their mouth, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people got down on their knees to drink water. So you can kind of see that. I think the idea was there maybe were men who were diligent, who reached down and got water and they lapped it up, and that's what they did compared to the others who just were oblivious and got down and on their knees and they lapped the water in that way. But the Lord said to Gideon in verse 7, "By the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and deliver the Midianites into your hand." So we went from 10,000 men who were a prodigious force to be reckoned with down to 300 men who are very much very small compared to the enemy, but with an ingenious battle strategy. It's very interesting. We won't get into that, but if you have time, read the account there in Judges. With that strategy and with God's help, that's the key for us today. With God's help, the 300 men routed the Midianites with a great victory. Now, we know that story, but what is significant about our particular text today is the phrase in the latter part of verse 7 verse 2 of chapter 7. He said, "You're too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel claim glory for itself against me, saying, my own hand has saved me." And I want you to just think about that. That even though God was with them, if it had been too easy, if there had been able through their own numbers to proclaim it's what we have done that saved us, that pride and that self-exaltation would be a glory that is against God. And from that we get the title of the lesson, that through glory for ourselves or self-exaltation, we come into conflict with God. We are against God. And there are basically four points I want to share with you along these lines. And the first one is how false it is for us to believe that we are self-sufficient. I think we all can fall into the trap from time to time that we get where we are by our own hand and our own hand alone. And that was one of the problems with Israel. It was typical with Israel at different times during her history. For example, Israel's battle with the town of Ai. I'll pronounce it Ai. I think that's correct. But you'll remember they had been victorious over Jericho. And the second city that they were to go up against in their beginnings of conquest as they sought to battle for the land of Canaan was a small city of Ai. We're told in chapter 7 in verse 2 that Joshua sent men from Jericho to Ai, which is beside Bethaven, to go on the east side of Bethel, and spoke to them saying, "Go up and spy the country." So the men went up and they spied against this city of Ai. And they returned to Joshua and said, now remember, they had just crossed over the land, had this amazing victory with God's help in Jericho. But they said, you know, don't let all of the people go up, but let about 2,000 or 3,000 men go up and attack Ai. Do not weary all of the people there, for the people of Ai are few. And so about 3,000 men went up from there, went up there from the people, but we are told they fled before the men of Ai. So now we have just the opposite of what we had with Gideon and his army, did we not? Now we only need 2,000 or 3,000 men to be victorious because we are greater than they. But what they did not understand is that sin was in the camp and God was not with them due to that sin. Achan had taken the accursed things from the city of Jericho, some of the bounty, some of the spoil of the destruction of Jericho. I may have said something other than Jericho. I hear it now. But the destruction of the city of Jericho, and Achan had taken that, and God has a reason to punish Israel because he had commanded that it would not happen. And because God was not with them due to their sin, they were defeated, though they thought that their numbers... And if we were to think about their numbers, we would agree that their numbers themselves were sufficient for victory. Now, I don't want to belabor the point, don't want to get political per se, but most of you are aware, if not all of you are aware, of the bombing of Iran just last night on the part of America, part of the United States. There has been talk about whether we would enter that war that Israel is having with Iran because of the need to destroy their nuclear capabilities, and Israel couldn't do it alone. And so President Trump decided to do that. He put some of the bunker buster bombs and dropped them, and they had a surgical strike against Iran. And, you know, you think, and everybody is talking about this, at least on Fox News. I know a lot of people are upset about it. But on Fox News, everyone is talking about how great our military is and how no other nation in the world could do such a thing, and basically that Iran is impotent before us. I want you to recognize that that has absolutely nothing to do ultimately with victory, especially in regard to our lives and our relationship with God, because if God is not with us, it doesn't matter. You remember in Romans chapter 8? If God is with us, who can be against us? But if God is not with us, we cannot have any certainty of victory. Now, it may be. I mean, there have been regimes over the years that have had power, and they have often oppressed for a period of time as God in his long-suffering allowed it. But always, God brings judgment upon ungodly nations. Maybe Maybe this is the judgment of God against an ungodly nation of Iran, but we don't know, and we're not sure. And for us to be arrogant because we're self-sufficient, that is something that brings many mistakes and many problems. So in order to understand that, the lesson here is that we can't sufficiently provide for ourselves. And that's where we had our reading from Brother Bryce in James chapter 4. People who say, you know, we're going to go into such and such a city and we're going to buy and sell and make a profit and spend some days there. Spend a year there. You don't know if you're going to do that or not. Now, you may make plans to do so. Have we not all made plans? Even insurance and provisions for our family and all that's planning. But understand this. Things happen. Now, I like to bring this example up, and Rachel and Josh may not so much, but they had their first child, Imberly, and then in short succession, they had twins. They kind of looked at me like I was crazy when they came and said they're pregnant. You know, we knew that were the case, and they came back and said, it's twins with big eyes, and I just died laughing. I thought it was so funny. They do now too. They love the fact that they have twins and they're so precious and so special. But boy, at that time the planners had something hit them that they weren't expecting. And that's the way life is. And they understood that. We all understand that that is the truth. And we try to make provision, but we don't know for certainty because we are not sufficient in and of ourselves to control our lives. What is your life? It's a vapor that appears for a little time. It vanishes away. What you ought instead to say is, if the Lord wills, we will do this and we will do that. Now, I'm not saying that you always have to say it out loud, but that should be the acting principle in your life always. I'm going to accomplish these things. I'm going to do these things if the Lord allows me to do it. I've given the illustration many times of the elder up in Tucumcari who said that I'll see you next Lord's Day if the Lord is willing and the creek don't rise. And of course, there wasn't a creek between him and the building, so that didn't matter. But he understood, and he always said that he knew his life might come to an end. He knew that Christ may come again, and he should not be arrogant about those things. And that's why we are to pray. In Matthew 6 and verse 11, it tells us, give us this day our daily bread. Forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. Don't lead us into temptation. Those are prayers to God about things that we need. Deliver us from the evil one. We are not self-sufficient, whether it be spiritual or material, in the matters of our life that we live here upon the earth. And we need to recognize that. You're fooling yourself if you think it is different. And there is a danger in that. And so the second point is the danger of not recognizing or acknowledging God's help is truly great. Again, you'll notice in Judges 2 and verses 10 through 13, again, why God began to send the judges to Israel. Because when that previous generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation arose who did not know the Lord nor the work he had done for Israel. And so what did they do? Well, they began to do evil in the sight of the Lord, to serve the Baals. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers who brought them out of the land of Egypt. They followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them. They bowed down to them and they provoked the Lord to anger. Wow. It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of a jealous God. It is something that is horrific. It is something that is disturbing. It is something that is scary. That's, a lesson that Justin brought up in his invitation in the 9 o'clock hour. As you continue reading Hebrews chapter 10, and you go down toward the end, that ruin and perdition comes to those who do not remember God, those who do not acknowledge God in their lives, those who are not seeking to serve God. And can you imagine the Israelites from all of the plagues in Egypt, the Exodus, the periods of time, the generations who were fed by the Lord in the wilderness before entering into the land, then given that second great promise that God had promised, the land promise, that he gave to Israel, and they possessed that land. And then Joshua died, and the elders died. Another generation arose like, man, this belongs to us, and we deserve it, and we got it by our own hands. Had nothing to do with God, and they began to worship other gods. How angry God must have been about it. Now, I want you to consider your own life in this regard. Just give a moment's reflection to the idea that you're supposed to live your life, the entirety of your life, with the first principle that God is to be pleased. He is your Creator. His Son is your Lord and Savior. He is the one that is responsible for your existence upon the earth. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12, the wise man said to fear God and His commandments and keep His commandments, because this is the entirety of man's duty on earth. This is why we exist. And you don't think that God is going to be upset with you if He is not first in your life? If you don't seek to please Him in your life, you don't seek to live for Him, oh, God's going to be okay with me following my own desires, my own practices, without any interest in what He has told me to do? Doesn't work that way. So many live their entire lives without regard to God. And again, the Bible tells us such a life lived in that way is a vain life. That's what the wise man said as he began his book of Ecclesiastes in verse 14 of the very first chapter as a summary statement. These appear throughout the book, but as a summary statement after he discussed certain aspects of our physical existence, he said, I've seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind. You can't catch the wind. You can grasp all you want, but all you get is an empty fist. That's vanity. That's uselessness. That's a waste of time. And a life that is lived without respect for God is the same. Now, I want you to note one passage from Hosea chapter 4 and verse 6 of the text. Israel struggled with this concept, forgetting God. At the time of Hosea is an example of that. We do that too, as I have already applied. But notice what is said about them in Hosea 4. He said, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. They didn't know often. Yeah. What is an amazing thing to me is that God had given them this precious law. And there were times in the history of the Jewish nation when they forgot the law of God, where the book of the law was lost for a period of time. And when it was read, Josiah, for example, at the end of the existence of Judah as the southern kingdom before they went into Babylonian captivity, he found the book of the law and recognized the fact that they had not been keeping it as they should. Can you imagine having God's word and forgetting it? But it's not because you have amnesia or you misplaced it and there's only one copy in the world. He says that they have rejected knowledge. Okay, so now can you understand it? How many families, how many households have that family Bible, that thick Bible that is set with all of the old-fashioned illustrations and the folded, or excuse me, the pressed flowers in the middle, and the birth and wedding and funeral pronouncements that are all written down as a part of their history? And how many of those Bibles have dust on the cover because it's never read? How many of us have Bibles on our phones, and we have Bibles that we have in our houses, but they remain unread and they're not studied? The idea is not that they're destroyed because they can't help themselves because their knowledge is not present, but they have rebelled, rejected knowledge. And he said, because of this, I will reject you from being priest for me. You have forgotten the law of your God, and I will forget your children. The more they increase, the more they sinned against me, and I will change their glory into shame. They eat up the sin of my people. They set their heart on their iniquity. And it shall be like people, like priests. I will punish them for their ways and reward them for their deeds. That is, you get what's coming to you, is the idea that's found in this, because of the rebellion against God. We need to recognize that there is indeed a great danger of forgetting or not acknowledging God. Just one other passage you'll notice in Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5, where the writer of the book of Proverbs, again, practical thoughts in this regard. This one has a spiritual, strong spiritual application. He says, trust the Lord your God. He's telling his son. He said, trust the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding. You think that you know how to live this life in such a way as to get the most out of it you can get out of it? You're wrong. Your Creator knows how to do it, but you don't. I don't. None of us do. But God does. You think that you can please God without knowing what God's will is? You think that it is something that is either acceptable or something that is smart or wise to accept whatever somebody else says about God's will rather than coming to a knowledge of it yourself? That's dangerous. You'll remember in Acts 17 and verse 11, the Bereans were noble-minded in their approach to God's will, because when someone came and talked to them, Paul came and talked to them, they didn't accept it at face value. They searched the Scriptures to find out whether these things were actually so. Because God must be given all of the glory. He said, don't be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord. Depart from evil, and it will be health to your flesh and strength to your bones. Now the next point we want to make, the third of the four, is what causes pride. Well, a lot of things do. And so I'm not going to give you an exhaustive list. I don't think that I could. But there are three things that I want to note that seem to me to be preeminent in all of this. The first thing is money. Riches. The Bible talks an awful lot about that. And those people there, they didn't have the same affluence that we have. Understand there are different kinds of riches. You may not have a few extra dollars in your pocket right now, but you had a car to get here. Most of you had. You have a telephone. You have food to eat. You have all of these things that our culture, living in the United States of America, benefits us with. And that's a good thing, and we understand that's the case. But it's a type of riches. Ezekiel chapter 28 in verse 1, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, and he said, say something to the prince of Tyre. So here is a noble man who is a rich man, and in this particular occasion, he got rich because of his own wiles. He was a smart guy. And God acknowledges this smartness on his part. He said, say this to the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord of God, because your heart is lifted up. That's pride. That's what we're talking about. In fact, the English Standard Version renders it pride. He said, because your heart is lifted up or proud, you say, I am a god. I sit in the seat of gods, in the midst of the seas. He said, no, you are a man and not a god, though you set your heart as the heart of a god. Behold, you are wiser than Daniel. There's no secret that can be hidden from you. With your wisdom and your understanding, you've gained riches for yourself and gathered gold and silver into your treasuries. By your great wisdom in trade, you have increased your riches. But then your heart is lifted up. You have become proud because of your riches. Well, that's the danger of riches in our day as well. Because it comes to that concept of self-sufficiency. How many people? The foolish man that Jesus spoke about, he said, I've got so many crops. I need a place to house all the crops, so I'm going to tear down all the barns that I have. They're not big enough, and I'm going to build greater barns. I'm going to put all of that in there, and then I'm going to sit back in ease and say, I've got many goods laid up for many years. Eat, drink, and be merry. And he said, you fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will these things be? We need to keep that in mind ourselves, that riches can cause us to become proud. Not only riches, what about position? We might say education and human wisdom, that those things can cause people to think they're better than others. In Jeremiah chapter 9 and verse 23, the Lord said this, don't let the wise man boast in his wisdom, nor the mighty man boast in his might, and not the rich man in his riches. But let him who boasts, boast in this, that he understands and knows me. That I am the Lord who practices steadfast love, justice, and righteousness in the earth. For in these things I delight, declares the Lord. Now, we'll touch a little bit about this at the very end, but this is really what we're talking about in our lesson today. You want to feel good about yourself, then trust in Jesus. You want to feel good about yourself, your wisdom should be divine wisdom. Wisdom that is from above. One of the preeminent concepts of divine wisdom is humility, as we'll see in a moment. And as such, if you humble yourself before God, and that's the kind of wisdom that you have, then you delight the Lord, and you are pleasing to Him. But that's what God requires. There's a third one that I think is important to note, and that is the idea of race. We see that in our day and time. I would hope that before many generations pass, that racism would become a thing of the past. Maybe that ageism, sexism, all those kinds of things would be relics of the past. But, boy, we have had generation after generation after generation. And my existence the whole time and preceding my life here on this earth in America with this concept of racism. I want to illustrate something for you in John chapter 4 and verse 7. It was the occasion that Jesus asked the woman in Samaria to give me a drink of water. So the Samaritan woman, verse 7, she came to draw water. Jesus said, give me a drink, for his disciples had gone into the city to buy food. Well, notice what the Samaritan woman said to him in verse 9. How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. The Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. That was a problem in Jerusalem, in Judea, in the Jewish nation during the time of Christ. But it was always a problem with them. God separated them as a chosen people, but that gave them this inherent idea that we are better than everyone else. And let me tell you something. There are races, there are people in every race that think because they are who they are, they are better than someone else. And that's pride, isn't it? That's pride. So the amount of melanin in your skin, the culture that you come from, where it was that you were born, I am better than someone else. And that's simply wrong. It's simply wrong. And something that Christians should have nothing to do with. Nothing in their minds should think that way. And it is so prevalent, so endemic in our society. It is a danger that all of us have, to have some vestige of that kind of thinking, perhaps from the way we were raised or someone that something has said in the past. And we need to understand that every soul is equal in the sight of God. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female. We are all one in Christ Jesus. And there is no difference between mankind. So whatever the motivation, those are three examples that we could give to you. But all of these things make people trust in themselves rather than God. That's the problem. So notice in 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17, using again the example of riches, because that's the one that Paul uses in his letter to Timothy. He said, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty. That's not to be proud. Nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches. You know, if there is one thing that I know, if I had $10 million, I'd be set for life. Yeah, you don't know that. How in the world could you know that? There are many people who at one time had $10 million who are in the poorhouse and have not a penny to put between their fingers. That doesn't mean anything. Don't trust in riches. Trust in God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. This is what the rich man should do. Nothing inherently wrong with riches, but boy, it's dangerous because the pride and arrogance can come. So this is what, if you are blessed with material wealth and you have this, this is what you're to do. To do good. To be rich in good works. To be generous. To be ready to share. and store up treasure for yourself as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. And that is a lesson we all certainly need to learn. And so, this is the primary point of the lesson. This is what was in the title. Understand this, that when we exalt self, we are in conflict with God. Now, it is stated many times, often without any reason for it, God exalts the humble, He opposes the prideful. James 4 tells us that, verses 6 through 8, He gives more grace. He says, God resists the proud and gives grace to the humble. So, submit to God, resist the devil, he'll flee from you. Draw near to God, He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Now, notice the reason for this. Hint is, it's our own fault. So, there is something that happens when we become proud. So, why is it that God would have such a problem with pride? I said, well, just some people are proud. Some people are humble. Some people are proud. What's the big deal? With God, it's a big deal. Why is it? Why does God oppose it so much? Well, notice in Psalm 10 and verse 3, we are told that the wicked boast of his heart's desire. He blesses the greedy and renounces the Lord. So this whole thing that we've been talking about, self-sufficiency and pride, it gets to the point when you're a proud in any part of your life, understand the final application of this, the most dangerous application of it, is you're going to do what you want to do rather than what God tells you to do. And that kind of pride is so destructive. The wicked in his proud countenance, verse 4, he doesn't seek God. God is in none of his thoughts. His ways are prospering. Your judgments, God's judgments, are far above, out of his sight. As for all his enemies, he sneers at them. He said in his heart, I won't be moved. I'll never be in adversity. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and oppression. Under his tongue is trouble and iniquity. And so ultimately what happens is, because you are proud and do the desires of your own heart, you don't think about what God has said, the life that you live, because of your pride, is something that is opposed to the things of God. There are a lot of sins that come as a result of pride. I don't know what the percentage would be. I'd not put anything to test in regard to that. But I'll tell you something. Much of the problems in the world, whether it be with regard to nations or whether it be with regard to individual men, if they would just humble themselves, and especially humble themselves before God, the problem of sin would be much less than it is today. That's just a simple thing to say. Because every time you sin, it is because you say, God, I know you said it. Unless it is just pure ignorance. God, I know you said it. I know that this is my will, but I really don't care because I have something that suits me better. Something that right now I want to do. And people can talk all they want to about weakness. But understand this. Weakness is not an excuse for sin. Why is it? Because God has given the means of escape for every temptation that befalls a man. In other words, God has given you provision that if you want to stay away from sin, you can do it. You have the will to accomplish this. Now, it may be harder for you than others. You may have to go to some asylum. You may have to go to prison. You may have to. There may be things that you have to do. You may have to get counseling. You may have to stay in the pew of the building 24/7. I don't know what it takes, but I understand that what God said is promised to you. It doesn't matter how hard the sin might be to avoid. You can do it if you want to. So weakness is no excuse because you have will, and ultimately, it is your decision not to do God's will that leads to sin. That's the bottom line of it all. It may be hard for you. There may be causes. There may be influences. You may be struggling. But there is so much that God has given you to help you through these things. And if you decide not to do His will and do your own will, that's pride. You can say, well, I'm a humble person. I don't have anything to be proud about. Well, then obey God. That's ultimately what you have to do, is to recognize that God is indeed in charge. And that's why God calls us to be humble. That's why 1 Peter 5 and verse 6, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that He may exalt you in due time. That's why Jesus serves as our supreme example. You think about the one who was at the right hand of the Father, who thought it not something to be held on to. But in Philippians 2 and verse 9, being found in appearance as a man, He humbled Himself, became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross, and because of that, God exalted Him and gave Him the name which is above every name. For Jesus to be exalted, He first humbled Himself and died on the cross for you and me. So as we bring our lesson to a close, may we all learn from Israel during the time of Gideon, using Judges chapter 7 and verse 2, that if we claim glory for ourselves, if we have that idea that we're self-sufficient, if we are proud, if we do not give God the glory for it, we are in a contest against Him. We are against Him, in conflict with Him. There's a passage in 2 Chronicles chapter 7 and verse 14. It was a promise that made to King Solomon during these repetitive cycles in Israel. And we're told that God promised Solomon concerning Israel that every time they repented from wickedness, then He would forgive their sin. But recognize what it said in verse 14 of 2 Chronicles 7. Then the lesson is yours. He says, if My people who are called by My name will humble themselves. If they will humble themselves, pray and seek My face, turn from their wicked ways, and I will hear from heaven, and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. And so that's what we call for as the lesson comes to a close. It's for all who are here to consider yourself. Understand that you should be humble. I should be humble because we are dependent upon God for our salvation. We are dependent wholly upon His will and His instructions to know how it is that we are to live our lives. We're not capable. We aren't in a position. We don't have the mind to know what God's will is. No man knows the mind of God except the Spirit of God. And the inspiration of the Scriptures tell us what God wants for us, and we just have to submit to it. It is not our place religiously to determine how we're going to live our lives. It is our place to submit to what God has given us to do. If we do that, the wickedness that we have done in the past is completely forgiven because God has promised that He would do so. And we can stand and God will exalt us because we have humbled ourselves before Him. So the invitation is yours. If there is anything that we can do to assist you in getting your life right with the Lord, then we offer it to you. Would you humble yourself? Come forward at this time while together we stand, while we sing.